I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest again today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome back.
Yeah, great to be back.
So we are going to continue our discussions of hotspots in the Middle East, and there's never a shortage of those. And you were actually predicting that there could be some instability in Saudi Arabia on our last podcast. And lo and behold,
right.
There's been a series of basically purges going
yes.
on in the royal family. And also these purges and machinations and arrests seem to be extending into Lebanon and also into Yemen, which was the topic of our last podcast. So why don't you lay out the background of what's going on, and then we can talk about what this means for us.
Right. So, yeah, at the end of the last podcast, you said, let's talk about what might be happening in the future. And I said, well, you know, a lot of people have been saying that there's a lot of hope amongst the current king and his entourage of a peaceful transfer of power while he's alive to his son, which would be the first generational transfer of power in Saudi Arabia for over half a century, because the Bedouin way of succession is of seniority, you know, to the next eldest brother. And it's not primogeniture like you have in Europe, right, to the oldest son. But eventually you run out of brothers. You know, no matter how many wives the old king had, eventually the last brother is going to die off. And so the very powerful set of brothers, the Sudairi Seven, over the past couple of kingships, had been consolidating power amongst themselves. They're called the Sudairi Seven because they are the seven sons of one of the favored wives of King Saud. And they are going to be passing, and now it's being consolidated even further, to the son of the current king, King Salman, to his son, Muhammad ibn Salman. And so he's only, I think, 32 now. I think he just had a birthday. He just had a major investment conference there, which I think there's a lot of crossover between our fans and the fans of Red Ice. They did a little show about the investment conference they had and their desire to build a robotic city and how they granted citizenship to a robot named Sophia. And a lot of people had a laugh over this because this robot immediately had more rights in Saudi Arabia than a female Saudi Arabian human being. But he used that conference where he was, I think in the trillions is what they have to raise to carry this out over the years. And this plan is being made where at a time where they've been facing budget deficits in the country because of the low price of oil. And perhaps, certainly they're still going forward with this process, but, part of the timing of this was that they had this major, major conference with very high profile billionaire investors all in Riyadh at the Ritz-Carlton on the same day. And all the princes who were big shots also had to be there at the same time. Well, what better time to start your purge, right? So as soon as, I forget his name, this billionaire from Japan who was one of the main players there, and as soon as a number of the other high-profile investors, Jared Kushner actually also paid a visit there, as soon as they were leaving, then these princes started being rounded up and started being held under house arrest in the very same Ritz-Carlton that this conference was held. At the same time, President Hadi, who is in the previous episode of this alt-right guide or white nationalist guide to the Middle East, we talked about him as one of the four main players in Yemen. He's the NATO-backed president of Yemen, and he is from Aden. He's from what's called South Yemen, this 100% Sunni area that's in the east of the country. He is now also under house arrest there. One of the major, I don't know what you'd call him, but a node of power within the organized Syrian Democrat, I guess you say Syrian forces that are anti-Assad, right, who is kind of a node of power in terms of bringing together financial and diplomatic interests. He's being held as part of this anti-corruption purge. And also the prime minister of Lebanon was summoned there, and he actually quit his post from there. We can get in that in a second. Maybe we'll do a little bit of follow-up first about the princes and their purge.
Yeah, so first of all, I guess what's going on in Lebanon?
So with Lebanon right now, there's a great deal of fear about another attack from Israel. It's just about 11 years since their last war when Israel returned to South Lebanon and did a great deal of bombing in Beirut. And also, let's keep in mind that Israel had occupied southern Lebanon for a couple decades, from about 1985 until the year 2000. They occupied South Lebanon, starting at the close of the worst parts of the Lebanese Civil War. But that's going to be, I think I'd have to really explain the sectarian nature of Lebanese politics and their really unusual constitution to kind of make sense of all that. I guess one thing I'll say about the princes before we move on to that is the two princes that to me really stand out of those arrested are three, let's say. One is the very famous Walid ibn Talal, who is he's a major investor. He was a big part of News Corp. He's actually a very smart investor, and he's made some big moves in times of global instability. So when the news media was suffering in terms of its business model being challenged by the internet, he bought a chunk of News Corp. He is a major investor in Twitter. He is, I think it was Citigroup. I can't remember if it was Citigroup or Bank of America. I think it was Citigroup. He bought, I think it was a 10% stake in it in the aftermath of the subprime crisis. And so he made his fortune in real estate development in Saudi Arabia. He's the son of a guy who was known as the Red Prince and who actually had some very progressive ideas and had to go into exile for a time. And it's not surprising. I talked earlier about how, let's say, the harem that you grew up in, the section of the harem, impacts political views and alliances. For him, he had a Lebanese mother, and the Lebanese in general have much more in common with people north of the Mediterranean than south of the Mediterranean, let's say, in their cultural and political outlooks. And so he got this in his mother's milk. This is Prince Talal. He was called the Red Prince. And passed some of this on to his son, Walid ibn Talal. And so he's got a lot of interesting ideas for the country. Now, Mohammed bin Salman wants to, he's saying, move towards a moderate Islam. Well, let's see. But so it's odd that he would also arrest this guy. Is it just that he wants the money because he's, they're hurting for money right now? Is it that because this guy also owns one of the major television stations within Saudi Arabia, he just needs to consolidate power from any potential sources of a challenge to that power during this generational change? It could be any one of things or maybe all at once. Another person who was arrested was the head of the National Guard. And now they, in a previous change, let's say the previous lighter purge, King Salman and his son had consolidated power over the police forces and the army. Now the National Guard is kind of a successor organization in terms of who constitutes it, of the Ikhwan, which is like the Muslim Brotherhood, no reference, no relation to the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, but one that goes back further than that. These were the Bedouins who were extreme Wahhabists and who, through their alliance, they were basically the foot soldiers of the Saudi family as it consolidated power and took over Mecca and Medina and basically became the most powerful force in the Arabian Peninsula as the Ottomans slowly receded. And so this is, when I said that their greatest enemies are going to be internal, this is going to be a big source of that because culturally these guys are, this is where Wahhabists with guns are concentrated, right? And so he arrested the head of the National Guard and has consolidated power over that. And then finally, one of the guys who is a childhood friend of the Prime Minister of Lebanon, because actually the Prime Minister of Lebanon grew up in Saudi Arabia. And so those are the three to look out for. Now, should I clarify anything else about that, about the Saudi arrest?
What do you think this is all about? And is it in any way connected with the United States and U.S. foreign policy initiatives and perhaps Donald right. Trump? This prince, for instance, was a very cutting and arrogant critic of President Trump.
Walid ibn Talal, yeah, this major investor. Yes, he was, yeah. And so there, some people have suggested, well, maybe this was like when they talked about a purge, perhaps this came up in the discussions, right, when the U.S. during the state visit, and that he would have said like, hey, as long as you're at it, why don't you get rid of this asshole? You know, he's really bothering me, you know. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. And I have to say, you know, as I watch everything that's being pursued all at once by this young prince, I think that what you see often in editorials is like, oh, he's this young, brash, reckless prince. When I sit back and think about it, like, okay, he's basically going from loss to loss here. You know, he lost the diplomatic fight with Qatar. Their intervention in Yemen is not going well. And the Syrian civil war is going to end. And, you know, Iran and the Assad power come out smelling like roses. And here they are, you know, doing what they're doing in Lebanon and Yemen and conducting a purge internally. You know, they're not doing this from a position of power, but from weakness. And I almost think of the art of the deal, you know, and I think that, you know, looking at everything Trump does through the lens of the art of the deal, it all kind of makes sense. You know, here they're pushing forward their agenda on all fronts, asking for way more than they can expect to get. But perhaps it's because what they really want at the end of the day is much more modest, and that is a peaceful transfer of power. And so by, you know, there's a lot of fear about a war in Lebanon. You know, could this be just a sleight of hand to turn attention there, or to turn attention away from the coup that's happening within Saudi Arabia? It's hard to say, but I think that, you know, when we talk about this, you know, we're seeing where the interests of white nationalists departs from the interests of pro-Zionist civic nationalists like Donald Trump. Lebanon is a very different kind of place than a lot of the rest of the Middle East. You know, until very recently, it was when the French left, the Christians were, I think, about half the population. In the 80s, they were about 40% of the population. Now they're far, far less. It's the Maronites are about 20%, I should say, and the rest are altogether they're around when was it? I think it's actually altogether at this point in time. You know, today it's much lower because of they have fewer kids, and also because of emigration. You know, so many will leave to go elsewhere, that there's been this rapid drop in the there's no official census at this time, but there's been this massive drop. Now, when the French left, they left in a system to keep the peace, which is that there would always be a Christian president and a Sunni prime minister, which of course leaves Shias and Druze out in the cold, right? And the civil war was a reaction to these changing demographics that were already in place, for one, and two, the arrival of all of these, Palestinians who were refugees and who, you know, should they become Lebanese? Should they vote? Should they be, you know, added to the Sunni bloc? And so it was I don't want to get too deep into it there, but it was, just a horrible mess. I mean, you had, you know, 20 different militias fighting each other at one point, and just constant changing of alliances and it was just total chaos for quite a few years. There was a great book, unfortunately it hasn't been translated yet. It's called Beirut 1976, a Frenchman that at the side of the Falangist, by a guy named Emmanuel Albach, who was I'm not sure which group he was in France, but he was in the kind of far right milieu of the GUD, the GUD, and who else would it be? I guess, you know, he's friends with Roland Helly and Synthèse Nationale now. That's who published his book. And he went there and fought with the Falangists. And the Falangists, of course, are building on, you know, the Falange in, you know, Spain, right? The same kind of animating ideology. But what he pointed out was how you can't really, this doesn't make sense to apply the same continuum of left to right there, because, you know, you have these people who are, you know, Christians, and they're considered far right because they're Falangists. But they, the rights of women and their role in society in terms of their view of governance and how it should work, you know, you compare them to, say, the leader of the Druze, right, who is the father of Wali Jumblatt at that time. And so it, the leadership of that community passes from father to son for centuries now. When he meets, when his, you know, he lives in a castle. When his followers meet him, you know, they bow down and touch their forehead to the floor. But because he wanted to enfranchise the Palestinians, and because the name of his, because his party was officially aligned with the Soviet Union and other, you know, Marxist-Leninist groups, you know, he was the far left, and he was the darling of the left for you know, many years. And so, you know, it's really about who are your constituents there, and not about what do you think, right? Or what, you know, where do you fall on this ideological spectrum? And so one thing that changed at the end of the Civil War was that they, well, they returned to this setup where you have a president who's Christian and a prime minister who's Sunni, and they made some changes to the breakdown of how they do parliaments, right, in terms of how each community is represented. And that was, then they came to an accord that was hammered out in Saudi Arabia in Taif, a city we talked about last time. They came to that accord because the Christian General Michel Aoun, who is, we're going to talk about again soon, took over as prime minister, which created a total chaos because that's supposed to be a Sunni seat, right? So that created more chaos. They went, they had these discussions. And they came back and they set up a new accord to how they share power. And the Israelis were kind of keeping the peace in the south of Lebanon with some allied Christian militias that became the, I think it was the South Lebanon Army. And the Syrians came in and created peace. And this was with the accord of the Christians up there, created peace in the rest of the country, right? And so they had the, you know, it was, some would say a power grab, others would say a kind of a thankless, necessary job of being the people who keep the peace between these folks who can't help themselves but pick up arms and kill each other. And so they created a more functional government, and peace and prosperity returned, peace, you know, bit by bit to Lebanon. And I think that kind of brings us up to the, you know, it came to the point where there was enough peace and prosperity where eventually when Israel elected a labor government, they kept their promise to remove their troops from South Lebanon. And then a few years later, the Syrians, it seems, and you know, with the accord of Hezbollah, overplayed their hand in an attempt to increase their control over the country. And they had assassinated Rafiq Hariri, right, the father of this guy who's now in the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. And Rafiq Hariri was a Sunni prime minister. He had taken over from a pro-Syrian Sunni prime minister, and he was pro-Saudi. And it should be no surprise he's pro-Saudi because he had hundreds of millions of dollars in business interests in Saudi Arabia and a very close relationship with the Saudi royal family. And, you know, his son was born and raised there in Saudi Arabia, right? And that's something that you see a lot in, so the, one thing that marks Lebanese politics is that it's sectarian in the way you divide the electorate. And each electorate is led by one or two or three different clans who are also have their own competing business interests, fighting it out for leadership of these communities. And sometimes their interests coincide with those of their constituents, and sometimes they don't, right? And so, yeah, Rafiq Hariri was assassinated, and that led to the Cedar Revolution and the withdrawal of Syria, right? And so that might be time to take a breath and make sure that we're on the same page.
So bring us up to the present day.
Sure, sure. So the response to the – so the Cedar Revolution happened. And that was a, you know, it was like a, you know, like, hey, what's his name? George, Gene Sharp, right? From the Einstein Institute, you know, one of these color revolutions. And so it was, you know, like many of the color revolutions, this one was very much, you know, supported by neocons and perhaps also by Soros at the same time, but certainly by the neocons. And this was a assertion of these, say, Saudi-backed, pro-American, and peace with Israel, mostly Sunnis taking power, right? And through peaceful means, right? Through these kind of, you know, Gene Sharp methods, right? The actually, I wrote a series about that on Countercurrents. His main work was From Dictatorship to Democracy. And so they used a lot of these tactics. They call it the Cedar Revolution. And, yeah, actually, and then later on, Saad Hariri came back and took over for an intermediary Sunni prime minister. And so the pro-Saudi Sunni political force, right, is now part of the decision-making structure of the country. The other side, right, the Christian president is Michel Ayun, who was the general who was very active in the Civil War, who was at one time, you know, I think he was a tank commander, so it's, you know, driving tanks against Hezbollah and other similar Shia movements. He's now the head of a coalition that includes Hezbollah, and he brought with him, I think, probably 2/3 or 3/4 of the Christian community to make this alliance with Hezbollah. And why would they do this, you might ask? Well, after the Cedar Revolution has successfully kicked out the Syrians, and after the you know, U.S. interests and kind of Saudi-Israeli friendly leaders were in charge in Beirut, Israel invaded in 2006 into the south of Lebanon. And the world was shocked when Hezbollah basically fought them to a stalemate, and they had to withdraw. And they failed to take over South Lebanon. And U.N. troops then came in and essentially have created a buffer between them and the Shia in the south of Lebanon. And that, yeah, funny story about that, and about how, once again, unusual political allies. I was overseas when the movie Milk came out. Have you heard of that movie? It was like about the San Francisco city councilman, right? He's like the first openly gay elected official in America, right? And so it was a big, a lot of expats went there, and I was there, and there was like an after party cocktail kind of thing. And it was, you know, allied with this kind of, this gallery put it on, and a few different, you know, civil society groups, put on this showing. And I was chatting with these two guys from Lebanon there, and they were from the largest, I don't want to say, I guess you say gay lobby or gay civil society organization there, right? And I was saying how I was like, oh, you know, this movie was really well done and really explains, you know, how political alliances, strange political alliances arrive, because you see the Teamsters Union, right? The beginning of his rise to power was the Teamsters teaming up with the gay bars to fight Coors Brewing Company when they wouldn't sign a contract. And these guys were like, oh, well, we've got one better for you than that. They said, you know, when this war in 2006 happened, the south of Lebanon just cleared out of civilians, right? So it was nothing left but these militants fighting in the mountains, you know, hiding out, waiting for tanks to get stuck in a valley to start, you know, taking them out one by one, right? And so they had all these civilians coming up into Beirut, and the gay neighborhood of Beirut was around, surprise, surprise, right, the nicest park in the city. And so what their group did was they organized a to collect blankets and set up tents and to collect food, and they fed and they clothed and they gave, you know, blankets, everything that was needed to all these Shia from the south of Lebanon living in this park, right? And now in their main office, they have a signed letter and picture from Sayed Hussein Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, thanking them for all they did for his Shia in the civil war. Oh my God, you did beat that story, man. That's like, how in the hell? know, the Shia in the 80s, they were marching down the street, you know, chanting slogans of Ayatollah Khomeini and the Iranian Revolution. And then here they were in, you know, in the aftermath of the 2006 war, you know, writing thank you letters to, you know, the gay lobby of Beirut, right? And it's amazing how different how strange the kind of political alliances you see there, because it really is such a diverse mix of people who are all fighting for their survival. All of them see themselves as fighting them for their survival, right?
Right.
Whether they're Shia, Sunni, or Christian, or Druze, or whatever.
Yeah, well, let's pause for a minute and just note that this is the kind of future that we are trying to avoid in every European country, every white country around the world. Namely, a factionalized, tribalized society like Lebanon or Syria.
Absolutely. You got it, yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's either going to be that or it's going to be South Africa is our future. Either one. I don't know which one would be worse. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess Lebanon would be nicer than South Africa maybe, or Zimbabwe. But yeah, it's like still, like it's you can't get anything done there. You can't have, I mean, any kind of, you know, business. People are always keeping in mind. If you visit a, somebody who's in like some regular import-export business, you go in Beirut, who's, whether they're Sunni or Christian or whatever, chat with them in their offices and talk about, oh, you know, things are heating up right now. They've all got guns hidden around their offices because they're ready for, at any moment, sectarian tensions to get to the breaking point. And so, you know, just as, say, you know, like your average Alex Jones listener, right, in Montana has got his bug out bag and his stuff there. I mean, there they have, you know, automatic weapons, you know, taped under their desks, ready for something to happen so these businessmen can fight their way out of the city to, back to their less diverse suburb, you know, to hunker down with their family. It's really a horrible, horrible situation. But in the last few years, they've reached a point where they have a more functioning government. They've passed more laws. They've come to more agreements between the communities on how to govern. And there's been a working relationship between the prime minister, who's Sunni, who represents the, well, you know, they call it they have horrible names. They call it the March 14th movement versus the March 8th movement, right? So I guess the March 8th movement's living in the past. I don't know. But the March 8th, 14th movement is this, you know, the one led by the Hariri family, the one that is, it's mostly Sunni, and they have, you know, maybe a fifth of their members are Christian, and that fifth of the members which are Christian might represent, you know, a quarter or slightly less of the Christian community. And then in the March 8th movement, you have this mix of the Maronite Christians, you have Hezbollah and another Shia party, and then you have a smattering of other smaller parties, you know, Armenians, you know, what else was there? Armenians and Druze as well, right, are in that group. Actually, it's worth noting, too, that in the Sunni group, there's only one seat that belongs to the Jamaat al-Islamiyah, which is the kind of the Muslim Brotherhood-aligned Sunnis. The Islamism is just not a popular thing in Lebanon, even amongst the Sunnis. So, and amongst the Shia, even those who live very conservative Shia lives tend to be fairly open-minded about the lifestyles of others, right? You don't have these kind of iconoclastic vandalism or let's, you know, they're not going to go and intentionally seek out Christian women who are unveiled to slap around or something, right? So, you know, Lebanon definitely has that part figured out better than many other parts of the Middle East. But anyway, so they were functioning quite well. And then now you have, you know, Hariri, who regularly visits Saudi Arabia, who's good friends with one of these princes and who has, you know, like his father before him, his, you know, the Hariri clan has, you know, millions upon millions upon millions of dollars of their fortune is in Saudi Arabia, which means that it's, as we're finding out now, at the mercy of whoever's running Saudi Arabia. He's summoned back there, and he resigns in a taped message on television. And, you know, I don't even know where he was. It was some kind of TV studio. It wasn't the Lebanese embassy, wherever he was. And so it's the strangest thing. You know, and it's still being figured out. I mean, basically everyone accepts the fact that he's a prisoner of the Saudis. He's been visited by diplomats from the EU. I'm not sure if any American diplomats have visited him yet. I know that the American ambassador to Lebanon took a picture shaking hands with the chief of the armed forces of Lebanon, just as a way of, I guess, showing support, right? it's a very subtle message while he's there under house arrest. The president, Michel Aoun, has refused to accept his resignation and said that he will not accept it unless he returns to the country. And so many of his entourage, members of his own party, members of his, you know, close family, had no idea that he was going to do this. You know, so the thought is, okay, this wasn't a plan to go do this. He went there, he gave this speech, probably under pressure from the Saudis. He's probably being held in confinement at the same Ritz-Carlton as these princes, the president of Yemen, and this fixer, you know, leader of the anti-Assad forces from Syria. And his excuse was that the assassination threat is just too great against him from Hezbollah. And well, since then, you know, Hossein Nasrallah has come on, given a speech saying, like, everything was working fine. We don't want this. We think that he's a good leader, someone we can deal with from the Sunni community. We hope he comes back and takes his position again as prime minister. So that's the state of chaos that Lebanon finds itself in this past week.
Wow. So is there a Saudi-approved new prime minister in the waiting? Who's taking over as prime minister?
So there is not one from the Saudi in terms of Saudi approval, and there's also no one taking over because the president of Lebanon refuses, and so does, you know, quite a few people in parliament refuse to accept this resignation. And so it's really everyone's left trying to make sense of what's going on and what are the motivations are. Is this to throw Lebanon into a state of confusion and to increase tensions there? Is this a, you know, some people are worried that Israel is going to invade again into the south. Saudi Arabia has recalled, actually today is Saturday night, November 12th that we're talking, 2017. Just yesterday, Saudi Arabia recalled all of their subjects back to Saudi Arabia and told them to get out of Lebanon. Now, this isn't the first time they've done that. They've done this before without, you know, missiles being launched. But this is definitely cause for, you know, major concern. And so, yeah, in Lebanon right now, there's a great deal of fear that this could escalate. Not so much, I think that the fear is not so much that there will be sectarian civil war there, but their fear more so is that there will be either, mainly their fear is Israel, that Israel will attack. And that's really the change where, you know, I think it's really hard. It was quite hard for me to understand why the Christians would make this change when they did to an alliance with the Shia, you know, thinking like, my God, these people are going to, you know, swamp you demographically and you're not going to have a place left in the country. But only if you think of it in terms of the greatest threat to Lebanon's territorial integrity and to their sovereignty comes from Israel, does that start to make sense? And so, yeah, so that's the great fear. Is that, you know, you have the Shia in the south, you have the Christians in the center of the country, and most of the Sunni are not in the area that Israel would come and take over, and would, even though they're definitely anti-Israeli, that would not impact them as much as it would the Christians and the Shia.
What has the United States government said about this?
So what I've seen so far is just they've encouraged Saudi Arabia to pursue their interests more calmly, right, in terms of messages from the White House, to, you know, respect the fragility of the region or something like this. But and then the ambassador I mentioned taking the picture with the head of the armed forces of Lebanon, kind of in a way of saying, okay, don't try anything militarily, right? One of the things that they've said, the Saudi government, is that they blame Iran for everything happening in Yemen, which is not exactly the full story, right? I mean, there is a legit local group that, you know, wants to have a say in government in Yemen and wants to have, you know, certain level of sovereignty there. And, you know, they've had some help from Iran, but okay, so is, you know, everyone else, right? This is not an invasion of Saudi Arabia by Iran. And then this, by the same token, Hezbollah is, you know, an Iranian backed group, an Iranian allied group. And so there's this fear like, oh, you know, we have to take a stand against this group, Hezbollah, as this Iranian proxy. And will they take it to the next level and start actually launching missiles into Hezbollah territory or flying, you know, these F-15s they bought from the United States into Hezbollah territory? I should say, too, you know, part of the – I kind of skipped over this. You know, Hezbollah has its own kind of exception. You know, during all of the disarmaments that happened after the Civil War, none of them applied to Hezbollah because they were seen as a special – they had like a special resistance movement exception, right? Because they are – they have the job of being the buffer between the rest of Lebanon and Israel. And so they're allowed to have this militia, and they're allowed to have this kind of semi – really autonomy is too strong of a word – but they have a great deal of more sovereignty over themselves than do the others. You know, other communities have to come to agreement, you know, whereas the Shia have a lot more self-containment, let's say, in the way they do things. And that's, let's say, that's the slice of the cake that they get when the Sunnis get the prime ministership and the Christians get the presidentship. You know, the when it comes to, like, who's going to still have power after this is over? Yeah, I mean, it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict. You know, there's also will we see an emergence of a kind of a three-way fight like we talked about in Qatar versus the traditional two-way fight where you have on one side, you know, US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and on the other side, Iran. Will there be this, you know, Turkey inserting itself as a third power? And, you know, I don't see any sign of that yet. I'm sure that one of these clans that's a powerful political clan within the Sunni community is, you know, having secret talks with the Turks right now. But the way that they've exerted influence in other countries via the Muslim Brotherhood probably won't happen because, you know, the Jamaat Islamiyah is not that not that popular, you know, and so they're not going to exert influence that way. So it's still it's still left to be seen. I don't know if that's it's kind of a lot to throw together at once.
It does seem very ominous, I have to say, that the prime minister of a sovereign nation has basically been, it seems, kidnapped by an upstart prince of another sovereign nation and somehow strong-armed into resigning his position. That I would think that the United Nations and everybody else, all these international groups, would be raising holy hell about this. What has quote-unquote world opinion been been saying about this?
It's been, like you said, I mean, compared to what you think it ought to be, rather muted. And I think that, you know, I heard this comparison made, that, and this is before my time, and I think, you know, probably before your time as well, that there was a time where American State Department had all these people they called Kremlinologists, because there was such a lack of transparency on who's in charge of what, how are decisions made, who's thinking what, when it came to what was going on in Russia. And, I mean, that's certainly the case in Saudi Arabia. You know, why? What is the overarching rationale behind what's going on here? And so everyone's left kind of scratching their heads. And I mean, there's a great deal of fear that this will turn into war, but I think that no one really knows what to do. And the fact that, you know, Hariri's situation is still, you know, officially ambiguous, right? That there hasn't been the kind of reaction you'd expect if, say, imagine if, like, the president of Mexico resigns from some TV studio in America, you know, I mean, or, you know, the prime minister of of the Ukraine were to resign from a TV studio in Russia and then be stuck in a hotel and only be able to have visits with people under armed guard and look nervous while doing it. You know?
So are they watching him to see if he's blinking in Morse code or something like that? Everyone knows what's happening. It's ominous. The thing that strikes me about this is that when we get to the bottom of it, it's going to be a lot of stuff that has little to do with ideology and a lot to do with petty personal vendettas and rumors and things like that floating around in the soup of the Saudi court.
Yes.
But the trouble is this is a very, very volatile situation. Saudi Arabia does not strike me as a very stable form of society. Do they have a very powerful military?
Well, they have a lot of weapons.
They buy lots of weapons. I do know they do that. But do they have a very powerful military?
Yeah, I mean, that's not really because, I mean, in terms of failing against the Yemenis, they're really failing pretty horribly. Despite their incredible advantage in terms of weapons and logistics. And I guess the main question is, can they suppress their own people? And they did a fine job of suppressing the subjects of Bahrain a few years ago, driving tanks across the causeway to mow down protesters in favor of a neighboring corrupt Sunni ruling family. Would their soldiers do that against their own fellow subjects of the Saudi family, I guess, is the question. They certainly would be very happy to do it against their Shia population. And in fact, there has been recently a lot of violence against them from state actors, both executions of clerics by the state itself under trumped up charges, and also, shooting protesters in the streets, right, by either military itself or military dressed up in civilian garb. But would they do that against Sunnis? That's a different question altogether. So now the other thing about all these tactics that they're pulling is once whatever kind of gambit they're playing is over now, what are they going to do with the president of Yemen? And what are they going to do with the prime minister of Lebanon? Are they going to go back? How can he go back to Lebanon now and lead his political party or lead his country's parliament? He's lost all credibility at this point. So this piece on the chessboard essentially has been sacrificed. And the same goes for President Hadi of Yemen. After he's now officially a prisoner, who can they possibly claim is the next legitimate president of Yemen after they've arrested this guy and are keeping him and decide they're going to keep him indefinitely in Yemen, or after they release him to do their bidding and it becomes even more clear that he's not a sovereign actor representing the popular interest of the Yemenis. In some ways, it's kind of all of these tactics have a dead end in terms of exerting Saudi power in Yemen, in terms of exerting Saudi power into Lebanon. And so, with the princes, the thought of he needs to keep them all in one place to make sure that there's no resistance to his rise to power, or he just wants to take their money and use it to, fill in the budget. And by the way, if you add the wealth of all these princes who have been arrested, it comes to about $800 billion with a B. dollars, a serious chunk of change, enough to pay for that robot city that he's dreaming up right now. And if that's what he's really going to build it with, he's probably more likely just pay for the welfare to keep the people quiet. The response of the Saudi Arabia to the Arab Spring was to say, just a reminder, no protests are allowed and no civil society groups are allowed, and here's an extra $60,000.
Right.
to each of their subjects. I should tell you one other thing. Someone who was following the I think it's the Arabic language Twitter account. I think it was Twitter account of Al Arabiya. They accidentally tweeted out a news flash that Mohammed bin Salman has been named King of Saudi Arabia. And then that was taken down within minutes. So, you know, just as like, say, New York Times has, you know, these obituaries written years in advance for famous people, right?
Right.
Are they just preparing this little slide and waiting for the moment he announces it? Is it coming in the next week or two, mm-hmm. rather than next year? But yeah, I mean, it could be that it's all just going to be about this, that everyone's going to be left guessing about all these other places, that Iran's going to be on a defensive stance, that, yeah, whatever else, you know, they want to happen. And it's all going to be eventually they've just handed power from one generation to the next, and Saudi Arabia will then, you know, move back, lean back from its aggressive stance it's been taking this past year.
My attitude is that practically no matter what happens in Saudi Arabia, their success is not something that I look favorably upon. I would like to see the maximum amount of chaos in Saudi Arabia. And I guess my fondest dream is that there's some kind of Ba'athist-style Arab nationalist military coup that mm-hmm. comes in and expropriates the trillions that are owned by all these mm-hmm. princes. That would be really something. The world oil markets would certainly be in chaos at that point. But
yeah.
anything that destabilizes the system, the better. And
yeah.
it really strikes me, though, that this is bizarre behavior for a client state to be engaged in. I imagine there are people sitting around the White House scratching their heads about this in the same way that we are. Of course, mm-hmm. they're probably much better informed, or at least they have
right.
access to much more information. Whether or not it's true is another thing entirely, you know?
Yeah. It's also entirely possible that they were given a kind of, maybe not a green light for arresting the prime minister of Lebanon, but, you know, a green light for, you know, something like, hey, you know, do what you got to do to, you know, consolidate power and to help me contain Iran.
Right.
You know, that could have been said in the meeting that they had not so long ago. It could have been said by Kushner when he came to visit recently and relaying a message when he came more recently since the state visit. And so, you know, it could be like a vague green light was given that would, you know, and who cares about the president of Yemen? But once you start touching on, you know, Lebanon, then it starts to become more noteworthy. And I don't think that in the case of Lebanon that this is going to be a place to send ISIS militants who have nowhere to fight. I think Yemen is much more likely a candidate for that than Lebanon. I don't think that's what's going on. But yeah, it could be, it's entirely possible that, you know, this is all part of a art of the deal, you know, anchoring going on in negotiation with Iran, because let's face it, Iran has had a few good years there, you know, with, you know, friendly, democratically elected government in Iraq, with what will soon be a total victory in Syria, and what will, you know, and the Houthis may end up being a kind of Hezbollah in terms of their settlement they come to in Yemen. And just as Hezbollah is a thorn in the side of Israel, the Houthis could indeed be a thorn in the side of Saudi Arabia. So, yeah, I mean, it's the bluster of a falling power, perhaps. Yeah.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, just when you thought we were going to have no more civil wars in the Middle East,
yeah,
it looks like the Syrian civil war is winding down, and so something new might be winding up, unfortunately. Well, we will keep watching this, and we will definitely have you back to talk about further developments. We've been going for about an hour. Is there anything you'd like to say to wrap this up?
I will agree with you that whatever's bad for the House of Saud is good for us, because, yeah, they are attached at the hip to this Salafi Wahhabi version of Islam. And every dollar that's, you know, spent fighting battles internally for them or battles on their border, you know, that's a dollar they don't spend building the Grand Mosque of London or, you know, paying off clerics in the jails of America, or buying textbooks for Islamic charter schools all around the world.
Right, or you know, stirring up new streams of migrants into Europe.
Yes.
From places like Syria.
Yes, indeed.
Although that's my, right. I guess my great fear, aside from the humanitarian problems that would be caused by yet another civil war in Lebanon. Well, first of all, Lebanon's full of Syrian refugees. If Lebanon mm-hmm. is in a civil war and Syria's at peace, the last thing that's going to happen is for these people to go back to Syria. They'll be streaming into Europe in all likelihood. And I just don't want to see that happen. We don't want any more of these people, frankly, mm-hmm. in our soil. And really, they need to go back to Syria and start rebuilding their country. And I really do hope Assad is magnanimous with these people so that they will go back and start rebuilding mm-hmm. the country. Because the last thing he needs is to erect a Carthaginian peace against all of these people that basically rebelled against him. Because he needs peace, and that's no way of finally pacifying the country. So let's hope he's magnanimous in victory.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think, I mean, he's never given into sectarian hatred, and actually, if you look at his general staff, I mean, it's not so far off from the country. The country's almost 50% Sunni, and his general staff is probably about 30 to 40% Sunni. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of hope for that, actually.
Well, good. I that's nice to have a little bit of good news to wrap this up. So
hard to come. You got to look real close to the Middle East to find any good news.
Yeah, yeah. So, Patrick, thank you so much, and we will have you back very soon, I'm sure, for another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
Excellent. Thank you so much.